From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in Radio West, what are the chances, really, for medical marijuana here in Utah? 5 years ago, that would have been a dumb question. Would have been dumb in a lot of places in the country. But public attitudes about pot are shifting and moving fast. So we're talking about the politics of legalizing weed today. A little history at first, and then we'll turn our focus to Utah. Join us after this.
You hear stories on KUER. They make you think and laugh. Sometimes they frustrate you, and sometimes they even make you cry. When that happens, what's the first thing you want to do? Share the story, of course. And thankfully, local stories you hear on the air wind up at KUER.org. You'll find news, podcasts, and all the Radio West you want, plus community events. When you hear a story you love, spread the love at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are certain issues that just don't want to wait for policymakers to make a change. Same-sex marriage was one of those. Go back a few years, and it seemed pretty unlikely, and then something shifted. A lot of things shifted. Some kind of abstract things like popular culture and people's attitudes. But the legal and the legislative groundwork was shifting, too. So was the scientific understanding. And then the momentum, once it took hold, it just couldn't be held back. The same kind of thing could be said for the legalization of marijuana in this country. Oh, the question of recreational pot is still very much up in the air in a lot of places, like here in Utah, but medical marijuana may be something else. Here in Utah, the issue will likely be on the ballot in November, despite the reluctance of the governor and most lawmakers. And probably the most influential special interest in the state, the LDS Church, is sending conflicting signals. We'll get to that a little bit later on the program. But we're going to begin with John Hudak, who's written a history of marijuana, where he tracks the inevitable movement of marijuana policy in this country. Hudak is deputy director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institution. It's a think tank in Washington, D.C. He's the author of the book Marijuana, A Short History. He joined us from the studios at Brookings. I'm wondering what you think the Utah experience tells you about how this issue is playing out across the country. I mean, anxiety, of course, by conservative lawmakers, and then you've got religious leaders. But then you have this fairly strong public support for at least medical marijuana in this state. So I'm just wondering if you think, is this how this is playing out in other places? Is this anxiety over it reflected in what you're seeing in Utah?
Yeah, Utah is reflecting what has happened in a lot of states in terms of public support versus the support of political leaders. Mm-hmm. There are certainly political leaders in Utah who do support this initiative, but it's pretty common for people like a governor or others to come out against it, to fear what might happen if medical marijuana is passed. Business leaders sometimes engage on this as well. In the case of Utah, the largest interest in the state, the LDS Church, has weighed in. It's fairly common that this plays out. But I think Utah tells us something more, and that is this will be one of the most conservative states to legalize medical marijuana if the proposition passes in November. And I think it reflects where America is, and that is that this is no longer a controversial issue for the vast majority of Americans. And if polling is accurate, and I trust that it is, this is headed for overwhelming passage in a state that I think if someone told you 10 years ago they'd be legalizing medical marijuana, they would have laughed at you.
Yeah, yeah. Is that the general outcome that you're seeing, this kind of momentum where a taboo and a stigma is just inevitably falling away and you're getting broader public acceptance? Is that just happening?
It's happening, but it's happening for a variety of reasons. And I think with medical marijuana in particular, people are experiencing it, or they know people who have used it and have found some medical relief from it. And because of that, it helps that taboo go away. People are able to embrace it with more ease. But largely, people no longer believe government scare tactics around this product. And because of that, I think people openly question what they've been told about marijuana throughout their lives. And when it comes to voting on this issue, especially on medical marijuana initiatives, these propositions are passing overwhelmingly in a lot of places.
It seems like everything about this subject is fraught with some kind of baggage, cultural baggage and social baggage and racial baggage, which is, I think, expressed pretty well in the confusion over what we call it. And this is something you write about earlier in your book, how much controversy has been associated with even the word marijuana. Some say it's a racialized term. Would you just say something about that? Because I think that is a good example of how packed with meaning this issue is.
Yeah, the word marijuana was used early on in this policy history as a racialized term. Yeah. When immigrants were coming into the United States from Mexico after the Spanish-American War, there was a lot of anti-immigrant rhetoric happening. And along the way, some of the people who were coming to the United States were using marijuana. Up to that point, the product was always called cannabis.
Yeah.
It was legal, essentially legal medically in the United States throughout, the first 130, 140 years of this country's history. But Americans, white Americans, found that they could vilify Mexican immigrants by tying them to this intoxicating substance. And marijuana sounded much more ethnic than cannabis did. And so it is a racialized term from its inception. But, and as you mentioned, I write about this in my book, the debate over whether to call it cannabis or marijuana, to me, is a silly one. If you call it cannabis, it's not going to stop racial injustices in our, federal prison system.
Yeah.
It's not going to change people's outlook on the product. It's just a word game. And frankly, there are much bigger fights to be waged than debating what to call it. And finally, most people know it as marijuana. Most right. people don't use the term cannabis. And so because of that, I think I use the terms interchangeably, but there is obviously a big debate about it.
Let's talk about what part of the book is where you explore, I guess what we could say is the kind of the profile of this plant and its purposes over the years. And you begin with some misconceptions. And one of these is interesting, that there's this idea that persists that cannabis is easy to grow, that it's like a weed, hence the name weed, I guess. But you see, the truth is that this is a plant that's far more complex than that.
It is. The term weed is one that reflects sort of the ease by which this plant can grow. And it is true that, what I like to say is it's really easy to grow bad marijuana. It's really hard to grow high-quality marijuana. I think that's true for a lot of plants.
Yeah.
But especially when you're talking about medical value and using it as a consumer product, the ability to grow a certain strain in a certain way, to have consistent potency, meaning how much THC is in the product when it's finalized, that's a science. It's an art and a science. And so while a lot of people grow marijuana and do so successfully for whatever ends that they want, when you actually go to a cultivation facility in the commercial market, you begin to realize just how complex of an agricultural product this is in terms of nutrients, in terms of light cycles, in terms of proper hydration, et cetera. It's a lot more complicated than, having a red lamp in a closet in your bedroom.
Mm. Do we have any idea how long the marijuana plant has been around? Do we have any sense of that?
Yeah, so we have evidence of it being, used in India and in Central Asia for tens of thousands of years. This is a very old plant in terms of human contact with it, and it's been used in a variety of settings. For medicinal value, for spiritual value, for a variety of things, for millennia.
Yeah.
And, you know, in addition to the cannabis plant, the way we think of it generally today to produce marijuana, the cannabis plant also produces hemp. And hemp has been something that has been it was for a long time a real staple product throughout the world because it is so versatile, because it has so many uses that, you know, in colonial America, the crown, the British crown, required landowners to grow hemp, to grow cannabis, because of its needs, its ability to supply naval ships with rope and a variety of other products.
What explains the chemical in it? Do we have any idea of what as it evolved as a species, what explains the chemical in it? Was it some kind of adaptation? Was it a defense mechanism? Do we even know?
You know, that's a really good question. I haven't looked into that. I can say that since it has become a true consumer product in Europe and in the United States, for a lot of time this century, illegally a product. Growers have found fascinating ways to change the plant, different types of essentially breeding of the plant to create different experiences, different levels of potency. And so while I'm sure the plant has evolved over millennia, the real evolution has happened by human hand,
yeah,
and on purpose to make what I think a lot of people think of as a very simple substance to be quite complex. And, you know, you have a market and you have a consumer environment where it is as diverse as the wine world is in terms of taste and profile and different types.
One of the things you write about is the effect, how the chemicals in cannabis interact with the human body. And one of the things that's interesting in the book, you write about that the way cannabinoids interact with the human body is, you say, a modern medical discovery. And you refer to this researcher named William Devane, and this was in the late 1980s, I think it was, who discovered that the human body is built to be, I think this is how he put it, or maybe how you put it, the human body is built to be receptive to the effects of pot, basically. Would you explain that?
In the 1970s and 80s, there was research going on largely to study all the harms that exist from marijuana. This was something that the federal government worked very hard to fund research that only looked at harms.
Right.
But there were a few researchers who were looking at the plant and the substance in different ways. And along the way, it was discovered that the human body has an endocannabinoid system. That is a series of receptors in the body that are designed to essentially accept cannabinoids, accept the products of the cannabis plant, or respond in certain ways to substances that mimic cannabinoids. And so the two most heavily present cannabinoids in the plant are THC, and second is CBD. And the way that those cannabinoids interact with the human body through this system produces a variety of different outcomes. It can produce hunger. It can produce euphoria, essentially being high. But it's also the system that's responsible for medical benefits from the plant as well.
Has it gotten stronger over time? You mentioned in the book there's some controversy to that point.
It's almost certain that cannabis has gotten more potent over time. There is an effort to make the plant more potent. But in honesty, people have been doing this for decades.
Yeah.
What was commonly taken by police in the 1970s tended to be weaker cannabis. Now it's not unheard of to have whole flower marijuana that has 20, 22, 25% THC in it. And so, yeah, it's it's quite likely that the average cannabis product is more potent now than it was previously. But especially for whole flower marijuana, what you would essentially grind up and smoke, the body has a very easy way to self-regulate cannabis. It's not like alcohol that takes time to kick in. If you're smoking marijuana, you know pretty quickly that you are high from it. It's not something smoked marijuana anyways that takes a while to linger. And so you can smoke until you don't want to smoke anymore. And so are you probably going to use less of more potent cannabis than less potent cannabis? Yeah. But it doesn't necessarily mean that inherently is a harmful outcome.
You write, of course, about the history of government policy related to marijuana. And you go back to 1906. This is the administration of Theodore Roosevelt. And it begins, the way the government starts thinking about controlling marijuana, I'll put it that way, is basically regulating it. It wasn't outlawed, as you said, in those days. It wasn't even taxed. But the idea was that the government wanted to, start to regulate it, get some control of that.
That's right. This was in an era where the government was looking for ways to regulate a lot of products. And so you have the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act and its following subsequent amendments early in the 20th century that sought to do this, to introduce regulatory controls, particularly over food and drugs, because of great work that was being done by writers and journalists and others profiling just how dangerous the drug and food supply systems were in the right. United States. I think most notable among these is the jungle, but there was a lot of work in this space. And so the first sort of the go-to move for government was not to outlaw, but rather to try to rein in uncontrolled processes. And of course, cannabis being a drug fell into that same regulatory scope as a variety of other drugs.
You mentioned opium in the book. That was becoming a concern at that time. And this is another drug that has a lot of racial undertones here as well.
Yeah, absolutely. When opium became was really one of the first drugs that the U.S. government was getting serious about regulating. It's obviously an extraordinarily powerful substance, one that we are dealing with the effects of today. But early on, it was also used to vilify Asian Americans. Part of that regulatory system that developed first around opium and then later around other drugs was, I think, half good-natured and half bad-natured. The good nature is we did have a medical system in this country that was killing a lot of people every year because there was so little regulation around it. And we didn't know a lot about what drugs could do, how they interacted, et cetera. And so implementing those regulatory controls is a very good thing to make Americans safer. But also when you have this was also led by this fear of immigrants. Yeah. And so, Mexican immigrants were vilified with cannabis. Asian immigrants were vilified with opium. And it became part of this story that the government would spin about the dangers of otherness. And those substances served as a nice proxy to highlight otherness.
We have to talk about Harry Anslinger when we talk about this part of the story. So at first, the U.S. tries to regulate it, and I'm guessing through taxation, those kinds of things. But at some point, it shifts to trying to prohibit it. And that brings us to Anslinger. Explain who he is and his story, because he's a really important player in all of this.
Harry Anslinger is one of the most important government officials that most people have never heard of. He was the first head of the Bureau of Narcotics, which was essentially a precursor of the DEA. And he was he served in that role for decades.
Yeah.
He overlapped almost completely with J. Edgar Hoover as head of the FBI. And his job was to crack down on drugs. And he sought to do that in a variety of ways. But one way that was, or I should say one drug that had a special place in Harry Anslinger's heart of hate was cannabis. And he would write op-eds in newspapers. He would speak at community group meetings and work with media to spin stories about what cannabis would do and to scare a lot of Americans about the ills of cannabis. And so
he was a pretty avowed racist, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a really racist guy. Yeah, yeah. So when you look at the type of information that was coming out of the Bureau of Narcotics, it would say that, you know, using cannabis would drive you psychotic. It would make you kill. It would make you rape. But there was also another dark side to it where he would explain that, you know, if white women used cannabis, they would probably sleep with men of color. And that this was, at first, as I said, a drug to scare Americans about Mexican immigrants. But later, cannabis became a jazz drug. Yeah. That's how it was profiled, a jazz drug, which of course meant a black drug. And Harry Anslinger, you know, headed that charge to scare people about the product, but also to scare mostly white Americans about the types of people who would use cannabis.
How long do you think did Anslinger's ideas, these basically manipulated or made up essays that he would write, and these ideas that he kind of put into the American, you know, public, you know, mainstream, how long did they last, did you figure? It seems like the whole reefer madness business was based on those similar kinds of fears and ideas.
Well, some of those ideas still linger today. Mm-hmm. You know, Harry Anslinger was notable in talking about marijuana's gateway effect, that if you used cannabis, you'd also use all of these other drugs as well. There are a lot of people who still believe that to be true. Now, granted, there are many fewer people who do, but for the longest time, the only information you were really getting about cannabis came from the U.S. government and its representation in media, and it was never a positive one.
Yeah.
It was never an honest one. It was always a set of manipulations and lies that were very effectively used to frame this issue. And it was true in the 1930s, but it's true in 2018 as well.
It's interesting you say that the federal government was before there was the prohibition, they were taxing and regulating these drugs, but that the states started to outlaw them, particularly marijuana. So were the states prohibiting this first?
Yeah, states started to outlaw cannabis before the federal government did. And so that was particularly true in the American West, so whether it was states or whether it was territories. They were, in effect, responding to this influx of Mexican immigration.
Yeah.
And tying this drug to Mexicans exclusively and finding a really easy way to lock people up for it. You know, there are a lot of laws that are pretty effective at doing that today. State-level cannabis laws were an early step in that direction.
So the rhetoric used by Anslinger was certainly working, but you do say that there was a decent bit of pushback by public officials and medical professionals. Didn't get very far, but there was that in those early days. Maybe say something about the LaGuardia report, because this is interesting.
Sure. Fiorella LaGuardia, the mayor of New York City, was he put together or he excuse me, he headed a task force to look at the cannabis issue in his city. The federal government was.
What year was this? Sorry, John. What about
sure.
What year was this?
It was, it was in the early 1940s.
Okay.
And so he was getting all of this information about cannabis from the federal government, and particularly cannabis in his city. By this time, cannabis was now being labeled a jazz drug. And so, you know, the terrible problems that would pop up in Harlem because of this drug was something the federal government and Anslinger would talk a lot about. And those reports didn't really match what the health department and the police department were telling New York City government officials. So the LaGuardia Commission examines this, cannabis in that city. And what he finds is that cannabis isn't a gateway drug, that cannabis doesn't cause people to become psychotic murderers and rapists, that it's actually not nearly as harmful as the government has been saying. And LaGuardia had a lot of political capital. He was a big-time player in American politics. And the Bureau of Narcotics lashed out at him for this, asked the American Medical Association to condemn it, and essentially sought to embarrass LaGuardia and vilify him in his own city for having produced this report. And it largely went got ignored. And this was true of many subsequent reports. There was a report in the Eisenhower administration and in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations and the Nixon administration. And every time cannabis was examined in a fair way, the government lines really fell apart, but typically the government's response would be to speak louder and table those types of reports.
So part of the story, of course, that you explore in the book is how political officials moved from basically from this intense kind of resistance to this idea to acceptance. And was it driven by public opinion? And when does public opinion start to really shift?
So public opinion was a bit up and down around this issue over time. It's not a neat linear line from, you know, Anslinger's days to today. And part of that was as people began to think differently about drug policy and as more people experienced this drug, ideas changed. And so in the late 1970s, there was a very serious effort to decriminalize cannabis at the federal level. That is, to make it so that it's not a felony, to grow or possess small amounts of it, but essentially to make it the equivalent of like a speeding ticket if you're caught. Yeah. And the Carter White House was behind this. And you saw public opinion inching up into the 30s instead of the teens in terms of support. Gallup started polling on this question in the 1960s about not decriminalization but actual legalization. Right. And so support, like I said, was in the 30s until the Carter White House and Carter's drug czar ended up being caught in a very embarrassing drug scandal of their own. The Carter White House had to move away from this issue just to save face. And the bottom really fell out both in terms of support for that type of move in Congress, but also support in the public. And Ronald Reagan gets elected president in 1980 and really reignites the drug war for political gain. And that kept public opinion quite low until you got into the 1990s.
You say the U.S. has a remarkably unpredictable relationship with marijuana, as you mentioned. It's not a linear line of from concern to acceptance. Where do you see us now? Because you say that you believe Americans are feeling uneasy still about marijuana, but as you put it in your book, seem to be willing anyway, to give it another chance.
Yeah, it's hard to get past decades of misinformation from a government. So there will still be lingering skepticism and lingering worry about something that you have heard your entire life is this terrible substance that only bad people use and only causes bad things to happen. And so overcoming that takes a lot of things to come together. One of them is generational replacement. So the oldest individuals in our society are the least supportive of cannabis, and the youngest people in our society are the most supportive of cannabis. And so as people die and, you know, new people turn 18, young people turn 18 and become voting eligible, those shifts can be pretty dramatic in terms of support. But the other is people's experience with it. You know, a majority of Americans have tried cannabis at some point in their life. And there are a lot of people who are, you know, casual or regular users of cannabis. And people are seeing that with their own eyes. The lies that existed in previous government rhetoric. And then when you have medical marijuana as part of the conversation, you also see people who either get medical relief themselves or have a family member who gets medical relief from it. And that helps change minds too. People are not, you know, all or nothing when it comes to cannabis. There is significantly higher levels of support in this country for medical cannabis than for recreational cannabis. Medical cannabis is somewhere around 85% or more. Recreational cannabis is 60 to 64% support. So that's a pretty big gap. Yeah. And people are obviously over time warming to the idea that cannabis prohibition isn't working. It's having a lot of really negative public policy and public safety and public health drawbacks, and that regulation, tax and regulated cannabis, whether for medical, recreational, or both, is something that's worth trying.
But you also urge restraint, a kind of restraint anyway. You write in your book that we shouldn't let the zealotry of drug war rhetoric gloss over the genuine issues that may arise. So you're not saying let's just jump in. Let's be cautious, I guess, is what you're saying.
That's right. We now have so many programs throughout the United States, medical marijuana programs throughout the United States, and now we have 9 recreational programs, adult use cannabis programs in the United States. There are different models to look to see what works and to see what doesn't work and what the drawbacks are to different choices over regulatory systems, et cetera. And so the drug war has caused horrendous problems in this country, especially for communities of color. But throwing everything out too quickly, which I'll say some proposals in Congress, not all of them, but some proposals in Congress do a lot of reversing the drug war without really answering the question of what's next. And that's dangerous too. I talk to a lot of people in the cannabis industry. I talk to a lot of people who are regular cannabis users. And a lot of people in industry do worry about the consequences of under-regulated cannabis. And you also hear, like you will hear a lot of people, not a lot of people, that's probably an overstatement, but you will hear some number of regular cannabis users who will tell you that there's nothing harmful about the drug, that it's fine to consume and drive. Those are dangerous ideas because it is not true that cannabis is good for you when you're driving. In fact, we know that if you're under the influence of cannabis, you are much more likely to be involved in a car accident, et cetera. Yeah. And so the ability to have policy encourage better behaviors is an absolutely essential part of this regulatory system. And some states are getting it right and some states are not. But it's critical both for public health and public safety reasons, but also if you're a supporter of legalized cannabis, you have to recognize that disastrous behaviors can shift public opinion. Simply because cannabis is now supported by a large majority of Americans doesn't mean that it will always be supported by a large majority of Americans.
Mm-hmm. So it's an experiment basically going
on
right now. Yeah. That's John Hudak. deputy director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institution. He's the author of the book Marijuana, A Short History. He joined us from the studios at Brookings in Washington. John, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Benjamin Franklin said, "Tell me and I forget. Teach me and I may remember. Involve me and I learn." That sums up KUER's community calendar pretty well. You'll learn new things, like how to make your own honey, or write a story, or arrange flowers. There are new events every week, and if you've got something you want to show people, you can post your own events too. Check out the community calendar under the events tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the politics of legalizing marijuana in this country. We started with a little bit of history, and now we're going to turn our focus to Utah and see if things will or can change here. Joining us now is Robert Gerke. He is a news columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. He's written about medical marijuana in Utah and about the ballot initiative. He's joining us here in the studio. And Robert, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I want to begin broadly. What are you noticing about how this issue has been evolving in this state? Have you been surprised at all how quickly it seems to have been moving?
Yeah, I mean, the public sentiment on it has really gone from lukewarm to very warm very quickly. And I think even the legislature has been surprised by how quickly people have come around on this issue. You know, the polling has consistently for the last year or more been 70 to 75% support for a medical marijuana bill or a medical marijuana program in the state. And so, you know, and the legislature's kind of had to grapple with how to deal with that. And it's kind of hard to say where it's coming from because there always is this libertarian view or libertarian bent in the state. But it has, I think, as other states have adopted it and we haven't seen, you know, Armageddon, you know, unleashed. I think that, you know, Utahns have been willing to come around. And I also think that it helps that there are enough people who have family members, friends who have either tried it or could be helped fall into some of these conditions that are outlined in the legislation that could benefit from it.
It's interesting, too, that I'm wondering if you think Utah is unique in the sense that, as you mentioned, there's this libertarian strain sometimes, but that always comes up against this kind of adversarial relationship that Utah lawmakers have always had with products that can intoxicate you, right? So alcohol for sure, but certainly marijuana fits into that too. And these are, for the most part, Mormon lawmakers. So they have that odd relationship with the, quote unquote, word of wisdom.
Yeah, and that's what it always kind of comes back to is we don't want children using it. We don't want to expand recreational use. And you hear the criticisms recently from the governor and from the legislature and from the Utah Medical Association. And all of it goes to you're going to have more people using marijuana. You're going to have more children using marijuana. The data on, you know, youth using marijuana in states that have legalized medically is kind of inconclusive. There have been some states that have gone down, seen the youth rate gone down. Some have held steady. And I think there's one that actually has gone up, but just a little bit. So it doesn't seem to have there doesn't seem to be a clear trend line in that regard. But that is the concern that it's going to expand into a recreational program. We heard the governor saying that he thinks this opens the door for recreational use. And the legislature has been very cautious, I guess, to put it mildly, in how they've taken these little baby steps forward for those very reasons.
Well, baby step this year was the bill that passed, which allowed those. The conditions were incredibly restrictive.
Yeah.
I think this is how you described it in one of your pieces, right to try as long as you die, Bill.
Yeah, you have to be diagnosed with a terminal condition that the doctor says you'll be dead within 6 months. You can beat the odds and maybe last nine, but it's for those people that have, you know, cancer or similar conditions like that. It's also a little unclear about how you go about getting the product, but it is again a baby step forward. Yeah. They did some legislation started a few years ago with some CBD oil,
right.
So, which is not as, you know, doesn't have the THC, so it's not as intoxicating, but just for, you know, children with seizures, you know, and then it's kind of gone incrementally from there. But as you mentioned at the outset, we've seen the public wanting to go from, you know, 0 to 60 while the legislature is still trying to pull the car out of the driveway.
How important is the LDS Church's position?
I think it's absolutely fundamental to whether or not this initiative will pass or not. They came out with a statement recently, sort of endorsing the Utah Medical Association's opposition to it. Their position in the past has been that they want to go cautiously, that they'd expressed some concerns about bills that had been proposed previously. And so they wanted to go. They wanted to go carefully.
What kind of a statement was it, though? I mean, this is the thing that's interesting, because, like, on one hand, what they say is that they don't exactly. You call it squishy, and I think this is a good way to describe it in some ways, because there's no direct opposition, but they say they respect, quote unquote, the wise counsel of the medical doctors of Utah, which is the medical association. Opinion. So it's an interesting statement in some ways.
Yeah, they didn't come right out and say we oppose this initiative or we oppose the use of medical marijuana. And they really can't say that because for so long they've sort of been willing to go along with medical marijuana programs in other states. I think it's noteworthy that President Russell Nelson is a former president of the Utah Medical Association and a former heart surgeon. So I think it makes sense that they would sort of align themselves with that viewpoint. It's probably worth noting that the Utah Medical Association doesn't speak for all doctors either.
Yeah,
there's a number of doctors who are supportive of the initiative. It was not a firm rebuke of the ballot initiative. And I think it remains to be seen whether we're going to see them come out more aggressively. And I think that could have a lot of bearing on whether this passes. It's worth noting when we've polled this issue in the past, about 2/3 of active and somewhat active Mormons say that they support a medical marijuana program, which is pretty significant. It's still slightly below the 70-75% statewide among all faiths, but the fact that 2/3 of LDS followers, and so this kind of statement could sort of erode some of that. It's kind of hard. We haven't seen any polling since the statement came out to know exactly, to be able to quantify what kind of impact that'll have. But we've seen it in the past on other issues when the church comes out against it.
It starts to turn,
yeah, and they can turn a lot of people pretty quickly. Again, if they come out more aggressively, I think.
You mentioned in one of your pieces recently, Robert, in 2010, before Russell Nelson obviously was president of the church, but he was a high-ranking Mormon apostle, he said that the church in 2010 basically had no position on medical marijuana.
Yeah, this was from a meeting of church leaders that were it came out on the Mormon Leaks website, and they were having this discussion about what the church's policy is, and he said the church has no policy on medical marijuana, not recreation, to be clear. They don't support recreation, but medical marijuana the church has no policy, and that's we've seen that play out in other states. I mean, if you're a member of the church in Nevada and a doctor is prescribing this, you can use it. If you're in Mesquite,
and remain in good standing with the
church. Remain in good standing. Yeah. But if you're across the border in Utah, then it's a different story, right? In fact, in Nevada, the state senator who sponsored Nevada's first who wrote Nevada's medical marijuana policy was a former state president. So there is this sort of willingness to accept it as long as it's being accepted by the civil authority, the legislatures of the states, and is legal in those states, which is also an interesting conundrum. Right, because if that's the distinction the church is drawing, is that it's legal in the state made legal by the state government, you're still ignoring that federally it's prohibited.
Yeah.
So they're willing to accept it if the state legislatures say it's okay, but not if the federal government says it's still illegal. So they're walking a very fine line, I think, on all of these questions.
I think if you're Mormon, it must be confusing if you have a condition that could be helped potentially by marijuana. In your own reporting, you wrote about Maddie Campbell, who had this rare degenerative disease. she's Mormon, her family's Mormon, and they ask the church, what should we do? What can we do?
Yeah. They one of her Aaron's her father, one of his missionary companions, had a contact at the church headquarters, and so he sent a question to these officials and got the answer back. Again, much in line with what Russell Nelson said in that meeting, that the church has no official policy. If it's legal under the state authority, they're and prescribed by a doctor, they're fine with it, and they see it. Yeah, he went on to say, I think it can actually be a great blessing to
those
in need.
Let me quote it from you. This is from your piece. He said, the use of medical marijuana can be a great blessing to individuals who are suffering with these diseases in which other treatments have failed.
Yeah. Well, and that goes to the crux of it, right? Because the church preaches compassion, and they don't want to condone suffering or look the other way when people are suffering. But they're again, trying to walk this fine line, I think, between respecting the state and federal laws and the stigma, I guess, that's been that your previous guest talked about, that's been attached to marijuana over the last several decades, and trying to navigate those issues as well.
So what do you expect, Robert, in the coming months as we head toward November? There's, of course, a ballot initiative here. What are you expecting in terms of from the LDS Church? Do you think they'll say something more definitive?
I don't think this is the last we'll hear from them. And I think they'll be put on the spot again, you know, to try to explain it a little bit more fully, explain their viewpoints. Again, whether they come right out and say, we oppose this and urge our members, you know, our followers to vote against it, that sort of remains to be seen. On the other side, I think the proponents of the medical marijuana programs have tried to reach out to the church and tried to, you know, discuss their concerns, and have apparently been not rebuffed, but at least, you know, it's not a dialogue. It's one way. They're explaining their viewpoints. They're not getting much back on the other side. So, but the church will continue to be active in this field. I think the governor, again, will be sort of a very prominent spokesperson. And he's said again the other day that he's opposing it and explained his reasons why. I think one of the interesting things is watching what happens at the federal level, because we also have Senator Orrin Hatch, who has said that he's working on legislation to try to broaden the availability of medical marijuana. Senator Mike Lee is sponsoring a bill with some other Democratic senators, Cory Booker and Senator Gillibrand from New York, that would at least decriminalize it at a federal level for those states that have legalized it for medical purposes. And so I think, you know, you have that interesting dynamic too, that dichotomy where whereas some of the state legislators are still reluctant, still think that they want to go slow, and you have our federal delegation that's maybe being a little bit more forceful on the matter.
I don't understand. I think one of the things that's baffling is, what is the difference, do you think? Why, between if the church would have said in the past and has said that medical marijuana is a blessing.
Yeah.
If you are in Nevada, it's a blessing. If you are in a state where it's legal, it's a blessing. Why would they oppose it here? Why would they oppose it in Utah? What makes Utah different, do you think?
You know, and that's kind of what I tried to get at in my column. They say in the statement that they want the science and the data to drive the policy. And it's a little confounding when you have 29 states where the science and data have, you know, or where the legislators at least have come down on the side of a medical marijuana program. That the church is okay with that and is fine with members in those states using it, but somehow the data and the science is different across the border, and it's inconsistent. And I think,
how do you explain it?
I think the only way I can really explain it is, I think we've seen in the past, because the church is headquartered in Salt Lake City, they see a little bit more ownership of the policies in the state, which is why, you know, they don't necessarily get involved in, say, liquor policies in other states, but they do definitely in Utah. And we saw it years ago with the radioactive waste dump, right? The church doesn't necessarily get involved in radioactive waste issues in other states, but it did in Utah, and it did in the MX missile case and things like that historically, when there are issues that affect their local headquarters and their you know, that they are more willing to sort of get involved. And so that's the only possible explanation to sort of try to untangle this inconsistency in their policy.
I don't want to put you in the position of guessing, but this ballot initiative seems like it's headed for passage. And then what do lawmakers do?
Well, they're going to, I think if the numbers hold, and there's not really an indication that they that they're softening, there is still, I think, frustration among the public that lawmakers have moved too slowly. I think if, assuming it passes, it's going to need a little bit of cleanup. The lawmakers and the governor have some valid points that there are parts of this initiative that probably need to be refined a little bit. But that's the normal, that's kind of the normal process. And their criticisms that the initiative process is not the best way to pass legislation are perfectly valid. It would benefit from having a little bit of fine tuning probably. So, and actually the proponents of the measure recognize that. Yeah. They recognize that the legislature will come in and try to tweak it a little bit. The legislature's already passed a bill that would postpone the implementation of initiatives if they are adopted, and that gives them a little breathing room. I think there's language in there that they're concerned about, the grow your own language. And what the grow your own language is it's sort of the hammer that forces the governor and the legislature to implement the law once it passes. Because if they don't implement it, then it defaults to you can grow your own if there's not licensed dispensaries. So that's causing them a lot of heartburn. And it's also a nice juicy target for them to say, well, if this bill passes, we're going to have people, you know, growing their own weed in their backyard. And that's going to be our medical marijuana program. And that doesn't play that well. So it'll need some refining. Hopefully, you know, the legislature keeps it to refining and not undoing. You know, they once they get tinkering with something, it's entirely possible that they'll go all in and just sort of roll back huge parts of it. But if it passes convincingly, I think they would have a hard time justifying that to the voters when they're called on it.
It's Robert Gerke, columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. Robert, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program was directed by Tim Slover, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.